Did you know that almost 99% of adults in the UK have a diet that doesn't support the normal function of their brain? Does that affect your quality of sleep, memory, focus, and anxiety? And that's not really a surprise when you consider that we cut large proportions of our diet out every time that Netflix releases a new documentary. Well, let me introduce you to Heights, a need to read's new partners. They offer you an all-in-one brain care supplement that promises to take your brain beyond normal function. Research suggests that it can take up to 4 months to replenish your brain, but within the first month of taking Heights, I've experienced better focus and a slight improvement on my sleep and a reduction in my good old friend, anxiety. If you take them just before bed, that'll make you sleep way better. So there's a secret hack for you. So I've partnered with them to give you 10% off any subscription, and I couldn't recommend them enough. Use the code Need to Read and follow the link in the description for 10% off. And when you subscribe, it's literally £1 a day. And again, the code is Need to Read. This podcast is also sponsored by BetterHelp, and BetterHelp do a wonderful job of providing a therapy service to millions of people all over the world on an online platform. You could be put in touch with a therapist within 48 hours of signing up and completing the application form. That'll take you about 5 minutes. So if you're finding yourself at a stage of your life where you're unsure of a few things, your mental health is not in the place that you'd want it to be, then there is absolutely no shame in reaching out for help. If you're into personal development and you haven't considered therapy, then there is a chance that you're missing a trick. However, I can offer you 10% off as a Need to Read listener by going to betterhelp.com/aneedtoread, and that'll be 10% off your first month. You can start your journey within 48 hours of completing the application form. So that is betterhelp.com/aneedtoread. And that'll get you 10% off of your first month of online therapy. Hello and welcome to another episode of A Need to Read. Thank you for joining myself and Jamie for this episode. Jamie has been on the podcast before. He's a breathwork bloke and he is an all-round good guy, host of the Man Down podcast and founder of The Breath Space. We speak about so much in this episode, spanning from just how much is enough to share your emotions, to put people off the scent, and why that's actually not a good idea. Expressing your emotions freely as a man and not letting that manifest as anger. And we speak about punching people and my past of being not very good at regulating my emotions. So please enjoy the episode. If you do love it, share it, tag us on Instagram. I'd love to see how many people are listening. And of course, that means that your friends are going to see you listening, which then in turn might encourage them to listen, which would be fantastic. So without further ado, enjoy it. So now you're full-time breathwork, full-time podcast, full-time you, yep. Essentially. How long did that take to go from doing your breathwork course or like kind of getting interested in breath work to going full time, because you did it as a side hustle, as it were. And I think a lot of people are attracted to side hustles because like it is their, it's their route out of working full time, working 9 to 5. You've now done that. I would say I haven't, because I just jumped full time into a podcast that was earning me no money straight away, because I was like, I had nothing to lose, didn't have a job to leave, so I just went straight for it. How long did it take for you, and what would you say your sort of main challenge has been that showed up on a, like quite a consistent basis?
Yeah, for sure. So I it was the 3rd of, weirdly specific, the 3rd of November 2019. Mm-hmm. I think we might have spoken about this before, went to this men's event and had this incredible experience with breath work that I would say, as cliche as it sounds, was life changing. That for me, I'd been doing about 9 months of breath work myself, but that event, that single event, I was like, okay, that's the moment. I sat down with Richie Bostock, who's an amazing breath work facilitator, and I was just like, how do I do what you do? And he very wisely, very astutely said, like, go deeper, like go do more, go to a retreat, just like really immerse yourself. And that would be my advice to anybody who has had that kind of experience with breath work and thinks maybe they want to go down that route, because there's a lot of people wanting to do that at the moment, and rightly so. You need to go as deep as you can possibly go into your own practice before you even start holding space for other people would be kind of my take on that. So end of 2019, I then went away, started 2020 to Sri Lanka to find myself.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. No, I just went to a breathwork retreat, did 7 days straight of like big 2-hour sessions, which again was just like this cracking open, and really just powerful, transformative week. And came back from that and pretty much started my training straight away. That was just like, I already knew I wanted to do it, but that was the confirmation. So, it was around the same time when I got back from, I'd been planning the podcast before I went away, came back, started the podcast, started my breathwork training, was still working full time. So probably looking at around like April, May last year, where I first started training. I qualified in, I've done a few different breathwork trainings now, but finished my main training in October 2020. And it was around, I'd say probably December, January time where I properly launched the business side of my breathwork practice, which is just the brand, which is the breath space, but is where I started giving it sort of more attention. And it's just really been, I think the thing for me, if I'm thinking about blockers, if I'm thinking about resistance, the main thing that came up for me when I was thinking about making that transition from full-time work into self-employment, or entrepreneurship or whatever people want to call it, was I'm naturally quite risk averse. So the idea of doing what you did scares the shit out of me. Like I think there's a huge amount of value in it because you almost have to make it work if you go that route. And I think you see a lot of people thrive in that situation, but I don't think, knowing myself, I don't think that's for me. And so I wanted to go through this process where I was making an income that I knew I could survive from before I even thought about leaving my job. And so I wanted to go through this process of being like, okay, breathwork's at zero, or my stuff's at zero, my salary's here. Where do I need to get to before I even start thinking about taking that step, taking that leap? On the resistance front with self-employment, there's so much stuff. It's just like, it is a continuous, constant cycle of, I'm the greatest, to, I'm the worst. I'm like, what am I doing? Like self-doubt. One thing I've identified myself through therapy, through coaching, through meditation, whatever it might be, just sort of self-inquiry, has been this sort of big fear of being heard and being seen. So like actually putting myself out there fully, which seems ridiculous. And I was talking to a client the other day about it, because we both have similar patterns in that sense. And at the same time, we're both in work and in positions where that's pretty much the crux of it, is actually like putting yourself in front of people. So it doesn't really match up, but it also, it does, because I know that this is what I want to do. And it feels, as much as the word purpose gets thrown around, and I don't think purpose is this fixed thing, it feels like something that I should be doing and something that I want to be doing, and helping people and providing that information to people. So it's been this ongoing battle of of fear of being seen and being judged, and insecurity around that, with knowing that I have to do it. And some days it feeling like the easiest thing in the world, and other days feeling almost impossible. And like, I don't really, imposter syndrome, I think, is probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. There was an email James Clear sent the other day that it's about like, don't feel qualified. Good. Nobody does. You can only feel qualified for that which you've already accomplished. So anyone just starting out is always going to feel unqualified. And I was like, oh my God, that is so useful to know.
Yeah.
Because I think feeling unqualified in the space that we sort of operate in is, I think that's just part of it, is not feeling qualified. And even outside of this space, like anyone goes for a new job, like you're not qualified to be a manager or a director or someone above someone. They just think that you've got the potential for that role.
Yeah.
So they put you in it as a test.
Yeah, I think one of the big things I notice, and this is more relating to the podcast, because for people who don't know, like my podcast is very specific to mental health.
Man down, check it out.
Check it out, go listen. overwhelming feeling that I got with the podcast when it got a bit deeper into it, like second season, third season, made up seasons just when I needed to break, but was feeling like a fraud when my mental health wasn't perfect. Like if I was in a bad place, I suddenly went to this place of being like, who the hell are you to be talking to people and not even giving advice, but giving guidance or giving a conversation about mental health. But actually that just misses the point completely. It's the whole conversation around mental health is that it's not this binary have not. It's an ongoing kind of cycle and spectrum that you slide up and down, and it's about managing that. And it's actually, you know, there's a post I did, it was in May time. It was just when I'd kind of left that job, was going through a tough time personally, and I was in a really bad place. And I was like, actually, you know what? This is the stuff that, not always, but this is the stuff that's valuable for people to see, because I think as much as we can champion vulnerability and openness and reducing that stigma, there's still with social media and in life more broadly, like conversationally, there's still that kind of filter that people put on. And I just put up this picture of me basically in tears being like, this is what's going on. This is the reality of it. Like struggling with social anxiety, struggling with stuff in my relationships, just left this job, shitting it about, going self-employed. And it's, you know, as social media is all about engagement, it's the most engagement I've ever had on a single post. And it just made me realize, it's like, what are we doing? Like, what are we holding back for?
Yeah, people do hold back. And like, I notice it in myself. And I think, especially for someone like me, and I had to have a serious chat with Lauren the other day about like just calling me out on my bullshit, because I share so much online, I share so much on this podcast that other people are like, oh my God, I would never share that. And then secretly, I'm hid behind that message saying, and there is so much here that I am just not going to share.
And I
keep it in. And I had to say to Lauren the other day, I was like, I'm full of shit. Like, as much as I'm telling you the truth about all this stuff, like, I'm fucking mortified that I behave in this way sometimes and that I hold back on this information. And she's like, I literally had no idea. I was like, I know, because I'm good at hiding this shit. I was like, and we all think we're so unique in our minds. Like I said this yesterday on the podcast. I was like, I think I've got one of the most unique minds out there, when really everyone's a fucking same. Yeah. We all don't tell the truth. We're all full of shit. And I say it all the time. We're all bits and pieces of shit. Mm-hmm. But it's about sharing. And it's that uncomfortable moment when you're about to say something. Like, nah, fuck it, I won't.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't want to bash social media completely, but it has a lot to answer for in terms of this striving for perfection that we all have. Mm. Like, people just have this horrible fear of being exposed because we are all walking on eggshells trying to be best versions of ourselves, to live our best lives. You know, it's this constant battle to be like, what do I share? And I think I've never thought about it like that, but for people like us who have, I was going to say public profiles, but like who do share more publicly, more openly than is required, we're hiding in plain sight because we're giving vulnerability, but our version, and we choose what version it is. And we all get that choice right. But you're right, people will then be like, well, he's being really open, so he's fine. Whereas there's that extra layer. And I think one of the big things that I really struggled with when Caitlin and I first got together, so a lot of my shit in the past has been really intense anxiety and like almost to an extent, and I don't want to kind of throw these terms around, but it came up almost like this PTSD response where it would take over my mind, take over my body, and I would turn almost into someone else, to the point where we named that version of me to almost take him separate. And this anxiety within the relationship. And it's not really something that I've spoken publicly about at length because I still want to maintain this view of like, oh, this guy's got his shit together. Whereas actually in the early stages of my relationship, I'd done a fucking load of work on myself and then came into a relationship and the same stuff was coming up. And it was slightly different to how it had been before. And there was more self-awareness there. And there was a little bit more acceptance of it and an understanding, a consciousness of what it was and where it comes from. But it was just as intense and it was just as destructive and it almost ended the relationship and all of these things that, you know, you don't hear about on the podcast. So
Yeah, exactly. And stuff like that shows up. And it will just continue to show up because the work's never done, unfortunately. I have this thing where I try and mind read, and like I'm pretty sure no one could mind read, and I always make, like, I remind people of that, but I never seem to take note of what I'm already saying. You know, they say, oh, the advice you give is the advice you need. If something happens, like me and Lauren are having a conversation, or like, I think texts, I think are fucking terrible things because you can never get tone on a text, and Lauren will message me something. I'm like, oh my God, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? So, well, actually, she means what she fucking said.
Yeah.
Unless she didn't. And you'll never ever know until someone is like, hey, this is how I feel. But I just try and read into things, and then I tell myself that story of, yeah, your brain's just different to everyone else, bro. You just haven't got the same brain that everyone else has. You think differently, you think too much, and start telling all these stories, and really it's like, actually, Ed, you're just full of shit again. You're trying to mind read, and you shouldn't do that because you've learned that that's not how the world works, and you can't mind read, and you can't predict the future, and really, you're actually nothing special. Yeah. So just start telling the truth a little bit more and asking questions when you're unsure.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, right? Because the thing is that your mind is unique in the sense that it isn't like anybody else's, but that's not special because everybody's mind is unique, right? Yeah. So it's just like, brilliant. You read that slightly differently to how it was intended, but you can never know. And there's this amazing concept that I'm probably going to butcher, but it's this concept of being over the net. So the idea, I really want to get this right because it's sick when it's done well. The idea is that there's three realities. So there's, if you think about it like a tennis court, there's a net in between us. There's my reality, your reality, and then the actual kind of bit between. So if I say something, I know my intention, I know how I communicated it, but I don't know how you received it.
Okay.
So basically, you can only know two out of those three things. So to try and mind read, to try and understand how it's been interpreted, or even try and assume that, is just nonsense. Like, you can never know that. And so it comes back to like how you then communicate. And it's all, first time I heard it was around relationships, when people say, you know, when you do that, I feel like you're not listening to me. It's like, okay, well, that's not the case, because you can't know what the intent, what your intention was. I can see your action, but I don't know the intention behind it. And it just comes back to the thing, it's like, yeah, we are all unique, and you can't know, you can never know the intention behind someone's action unless you ask, unless it's communicated to you. I probably butchered that, but
no,
it's quite,
I think you did a good job, because I've seen you share that before, and
I
didn't want to say anything, but yeah, you did do a good job there. And I think people forget that, like, even if you do ask someone, they can still lie to you.
Yeah.
So you will actually never know. And there's something quite liberating in that. I mean, like, actually, oh, do you know what? I'll never know for sure. So I'll just suppose I'll practice trusting someone, because that'll probably be quite a good idea. And that over the net thing, I've seen you share something of that before. It's about like, oh, I feel like you're not listening. It's, okay, well, that's not actually a feeling.
Yeah.
You think I'm not listening. Mm-hmm. And the truth is actually I am listening. And saying, oh, I feel like you're, stop. It's like, stop it. That's not a feeling. Yeah.
You can't tell me what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Only I know that.
Yeah.
You can tell me how you're interpreting it. It's like, when you do that thing, it seems to me like you are not listening. Like, it's language. I think that's where it gets messy, is because it's such subtle language.
Yeah, there's so many different things in language, like non-violent communication.
Yeah.
And so Giles, my flatmate, like, when we communicate, like, we're bang on it, because we've both done loads of therapy, and we know how to, like, play on our own side of the court and just serve something up. And we're like, how amazing would it be if everyone could just speak like this with pure transparency all the time? And there are so many times that me and Giles will be sat together, we're about to say something, I'll have that feeling in my chest of like, go on, Ed, lie about how you feel, lie about how you feel. I'm like, no,
not today.
I'll tell the truth. So we have like a decent, solid relationship built on honesty. And hey, it's one of the fucking best friendships I've ever had in my life, purely because of that. And I think as blokes, it's really rare to have an honest relationship where you say how you feel as well. Like, feelings don't often come into relationships, blokes. And I suppose that comes into like with your podcast, what you're trying to encourage is making people feel seen or know how to put stuff out there so that they can even be seen in the first place, let alone just feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I nicked it from you actually. When I talk about the podcast, it all comes back to like leading by example.
Yeah.
Like everyone's like, what's your mission with the podcast? What's your intention? Like, what do you want to achieve with it? And there's not a specific goal, which I know for some, you know, biohackers and productivity experts will be, you know, devil talk. But my goal with it is simply to enable those conversations to happen for other people. Like I don't really want to say you need to do this or you need to do that. It's just like people take on stuff in their own way, in their own time, to be able to see a conversation, as you said, like between two blokes where there are feelings involved and there are like things being spoken about that are potentially normally taboo.
Yeah.
They're like, oh shit. Like they're talking about this on a podcast. So maybe I can talk about this with my mate.
Yeah.
In behind closed doors. And I think as well, one thing, and this is just my take on it, but one thing that I think hampers men, and this is how we're brought up rather than anyone's specific personal issue, is that the advice is always to talk about how you feel. But actually, I think there's a step before that, which is actually to figure out how you feel. And getting used to having those honest conversations is the way to do that, because you actually stop and think, how do I actually feel about this? Or you might have like quite a visceral feeling of frustration or anger or joy, whatever it might be. But to go a step behind that and be like, where's that coming from? Like, what's the root of that? What is causing that? Rather than just being like, you're making me feel angry. It's like, well, why am I feeling that? And actually helping yourself cultivate that practice of self-inquiry, of figuring out how you feel and why you feel it, and then being able to communicate it is the sort of step afterwards, rather than just trying to say, talk about how you feel, like shaking people, being like, tell me how you feel. And people will just be like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
Because we've never been taught how to do that or how to understand that.
That's interesting. And I think that's like when you said about like feeling angry, I think anger comes after an emotion that then causes frustration, a lack of ability to express it. And then that just manifests as anger. So there are so many things that can like precede anger, like shame, guilt, confusion, like being hurt, feeling let down. There are so many different things that when not expressed, just like, okay, anger is an easier emotion here. Mm. I'll just lash out. I'll be angry. And that's a shame. And I think that happens in men a lot more often than it does in women, because they are able to label their emotions. I'm like, do you know what? I feel really hurt.
Yeah.
Like me when I was younger, I was such a prick and I'd punch people all the time. And like I got in trouble with the police for it, but that's my own fault for doing something there. And it was the one time where there was actually probably a good reason for me to do something. But so many countless times before that, I'd be out in a club, someone would like push me, I'd feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
I'd feel belittled. Okay, I don't want to deal with those two emotions. I'll just get angry.
Yeah.
And when I was younger, I used to cry whenever I got angry. And that hasn't really stopped as I've got older.
Yeah.
So like I had to really shut down everything and just become deadpan, dead in the face, and just be angry and silent. And that was so damaging to me in terms of like emotionally being able to express my emotions. That sucked.
Yeah.
And I mean, punching people just isn't cool. Like, it sucks. Like, you could literally, my mum used to say it when I was younger, like, you could kill someone if you punch someone. I was thinking, mum, like, I'm not that strong. But like, you hear so many stories of just
horrible
like
stories.
One punch, someone hits the floor, that's it, done.
Yeah.
One of my friends knocked me out on Christmas Eve once, rightfully so, because I did punch him first, but he knocked me out, I hit the floor, hit my head on the floor, and that was me. I came around in hospital, my dad picked me up at like 4 or 5 hours later. I was like, oh my God, Dad, I was so quick in there, I've only been in like half an hour, and it's Christmas Eve, and my girlfriend at the time was like, you've been here for 5 hours.
Fuck.
I was like, Jesus.
Yeah.
But I could have easily just hit my head, something could have flipped my brain, dead.
Yeah.
And it's so dumb.
Yeah, it is. It's such a, you know, there's so much around masculinity and anger and how it, as you said, it's like this, there's so many emotions underlying that just end up being expressed as anger because, you know, not to dive into patriarchy too early, but like that is what it creates. If your view of being a man and of masculinity is sort of tied to this expression of power and of force over others, because that's how you maintain your status or your esteem, yeah, it's going to be anger, because that's what people shy away from if it's done in a way that's aggressive.
Yeah,
I remember listening, there was a podcast, Aubrey Marcus podcast, with a guy called Eric Godsey, and they talk about the three types of anger, which I really like. So they talk about rage, which aims to destroy. They talk about unclean anger, which contains resentment and aims to hurt or harm. And then they talk about clean anger, which attempts to resolve. So it's sort of these different, like, anger isn't a bad thing,
yeah,
when it's done in the right way. Like, you're well within your right to be angry about something, but how you communicate it and how you understand it and interpret it yourself,
yeah,
and then convey it to someone else completely changes how it will be received and completely changes, like, the aim and the goal of it. Like, yeah, where is that anger coming from? But also, what do you hope to achieve with it? Because I've always been, you know, people pleaser, like overly nice. I've always struggled with anger, and I always just said to myself, I was like, I'm just not an angry person. Like, I'm just a nice guy. I'm just a nice guy. When really I was just terrified of conflict and didn't know how to express anger in a way that wasn't rage.
Okay.
So it was like, how can I've had to really work at it. How can I actually feel frustrated or angry about something and communicate it in a way that isn't, you know, really rageful and sort of harmful towards the other person.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think when I'm trying to think of what I was about to say there, and okay, I remembered it now, luckily.
Good.
So this weekend, Reading Festival, I wrote down on my notes at the time to write about egos at festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And what I could see as I was walking around, firstly, I recognised I was one, like, I felt old there. There were a lot of young men there. And there were a lot of young men who so clearly didn't have a handle on their emotions, so clearly had severe ego issues. And I was just terrified the whole time of just being punched out of nowhere for just accidentally walking into someone or something like that. So that kind of environment where there are a bunch of blokes who can't handle their emotions, they're the same blokes who will be out there like, oh, you fucking pussy, what are you fucking crying for? You fucking pussy. Like, actually, I think you're the one who fucking sucks, because you can't even control your own emotions. You have no handle on yourself as a person. So you let that out as rage, and you let that out as punching people, as belittling people, as like being nasty to girls and shit like that. And it's almost as if they sit there on their high horse of like, I am so fucking tough.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, then tell me what last upset you.
Yeah.
Tell me what upset you. Look me in the eyes and tell me how upset you are, and they wouldn't be able to do it.
It's fear. It's fear of self. Like, they're terrified of themselves, right? And so they hide behind anger to a point where it almost becomes an identity.
Yeah.
And like, it becomes so attached to their ego that they can't detach from it and actually get back to sort of, it just becomes them. They become just this like angry ball of fear and testosterone.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm just moaning about it now, because I have no way to fix it.
Yeah.
Apart from them going to therapy and being open to it, but firstly they would have to be open to it, and I don't think that is going to happen for a long time. And you mentioned the patriarchy there.
Mm.
Patriarchy is one of those words that people say, and like, they almost feel a little bit of shame around saying it.
Mm.
At IFS this week, do you follow Amelia Thompson?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
She's brilliant. She does like nutrition-y kind of shit on Instagram. She asked a question to a fitness panel about like calling out bullshit in the fitness industry, and she was like, right, well, it's only 1 p.m. and I've said patriarchy, and then carried on with what she was going to say. But it's almost as if she like felt shame about saying it. But she talks about it a lot, because it is such a relevant topic that somewhere men just like took over. I mean, no, it hasn't always been like that. Egypt, led by a lot of women, ancient sort of temples were run by priestesses and stuff like that. At some point, that changed and turned into a bunch of men. I watched a Donald Trump documentary last night.
It's mad.
That is fragile masculinity at its finest. Apparently, for the first 2 weeks of his presidency, regardless of what the meeting was about, he would bring out a board full of all the states that he won and was telling everyone how he beat Hillary in each state, because he just couldn't. He just couldn't shut up about the fact that he'd beaten her.
Mm.
I was like, mate, no one cares.
Yeah.
And like, then one of the first people he employed as his like Secretary of Defense, his nickname was Mad Dog.
Yeah.
I was like, this is mental.
It's mad. I think there was a really good Brené Brown quote that I heard, which was basically, it's something to do with essentially the people who feel like power is finite will go down fighting. So essentially saying in context of patriarchy and society at the moment, as the person of privilege, so men in a patriarchal society or a certain type of men, when people call out that privilege and try and level the playing field, they all of a sudden, and we saw this a lot with the conversation around male violence against women, being called out on your privilege, a lot of people's reaction as the privileged party is to go on the defensive.
Yeah.
And by going on the defensive, they start going down fighting, and then you hear all this chat around like, you're just trying to attack masculinity, you're trying to attack men, you're trying to like take away what we have. And that's just not it. I think there is so much like patriarchy and feminism for me are words, when I say them on podcasts, like they do bring up resistance because there is stigma attached to them, and both of those things are things that really need to be discussed, because feminism for me really is a movement towards pure equality. It's not about less for men and more for women. It's about leveling the playing field so everybody has more. It's about, you know, if we want to go into it, like abundance, it's this idea that power isn't finite, that abundance isn't finite. Like there is enough for everybody, and it would actually make the world a much happier, much better place if everything was more level.
Yeah.
But there's a demographic of usually white, usually quite old, but not always, men, usually sort of middle upper class, who feel that that is their identity. That is who they are, is this sort of, their idea of masculinity is power through the imposition of force over other parties. So if someone tries to take that away, that's all they have. And so they do feel like they're losing out, and they probably would lose out because they've got nothing else. And it's sort of this very deep attachment to their idea of masculinity. And, you know, again, there's this whole conversation around toxic masculinity that is really interesting at the moment. But yeah, there's a lot to be said around the conversation around patriarchy, because we need to get away from this idea that it's an attack on men. It's just an attack on a system that, if we can change it, it's not even an attack, it's just a call for change for a system. And if we can change it in the right way, it will benefit everybody, because the negatives of patriarchy for men are what we're starting to see more and more in conversation around, what we see with male suicide and the impacts on the stuff we've already talked about emotional availability and emotional awareness and the ability to have those kinds of conversations. So yeah, it's a bit of a rabbit hole.
Mate, I'm glad we went down there. I feel it's you, that was very eloquently put, all of what you said just there, and that's kind of what it comes down to, is like all of that will then lead to rage, which then leads to people thinking like it's immature to think anything is really finite in life. Like there are some things that are, of course, like there's a finite number of Bitcoin out there, apparently, all of that shit. But power and stuff like that, like as whilst you were talking there, I was thinking, I was obviously thinking of like, how the hell am I going to reply to this? Because this was quite a lot of information. And I don't know how to respond to that, because I think you said everything there, and I have no questions.
Shall I go?
You don't have to go yet. Like, I want at least another 20 minutes out of you. But it was really well put, and I think you know your stuff about that.
Thank you.
Which is interesting.
That's like reassuring.
How have you come to that?
Listening.
Yeah.
Literally just listening. I think for me, a big part of my journey with the podcast was wanting to, you know, big goal, wanting to reduce the number of young men taking their own lives.
Yeah.
That was the kind of core behind it. And as I've gone through that process, it went from like, how do we get, as I kind of touched on, how do we get more men talking about their feelings? And I was like, it's nothing to do with that. There's so much before we get to that point. Like there's a whole load of work that needs to be done before we get to that point. And it's being done. But through that journey, I then sort of came to this overarching theme of patriarchy and went through my own journey with that to be like, this isn't about men. Well, it is about men, but it's not about the reduction of power. It's about a change in discussion around how we view success, how we view power, how we raise boys, how we raise girls, how we integrate gender fluidity, non-binary into that. And there's an amazing podcast on Justin Baldoni, a guy called Justin Baldoni. He's got a podcast called Man Enough, and he did an episode with a person, non-binary person called Alok. I can't remember their surname. And it's incredible. And it basically talks about how if your version of feminism doesn't include non-binary, then you're actually not helping, because this isn't about men and women. This is about everybody and kind of that full spectrum of
But
gender.
Isn't feminism about women, or is it not?
My version, as a straight white middle class man, who I'm sure there are plenty of people going, you don't get to say what feminism is, but for me, feminism is about gender equality and moving away from patriarchy.
Yeah.
So it's not, and this again is where I think these male rights activists get a bee in their bonnet and just miss the mark. And some feminists or people who might call themselves feminists are off the mark, in my opinion, is that we have this understanding of feminism as raising women up and bringing men down.
Yeah.
And that's a very basic understanding of it that completely misses the nuance of non-binary, gender fluidity, the negative impact of patriarchy on men. Like, there are so many other factors where it's not as simple as women's rights, men's rights. That's one part of it. But it's also just about, like, look at the system. How is this negatively impacting everybody, and how can we change it to make it better for everybody?
Yeah. It's such a huge topic that is full of there is so much scope for error there to put a foot wrong, to say something wrong. And I just don't think anyone is really right. I think when it comes to, like, feminism... I read Girl, Woman, Other the other day. I can't see it on my shelf, but like, it was a brilliant book that was about like black feminism. And even saying it on the podcast in which I reviewed it, I was like, I will never be black, or I will never be a woman. And I was like, maybe I don't want to ever be. And like, I'm dancing around this topic through ignorance because like, I don't know what to say, and people are afraid to say things. And what is kind of sort of frustrating at the moment is people get told off by people who aren't actually experiencing the hurt of whoever that person is meant to have offended.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I think one thing that I find myself thinking and talking about quite a lot is this inability to make mistakes. No one's allowed to make mistakes, and
sucks.
That
humans.
Is bullshit. Like, in its purest form, I think that is one of the biggest problems we see with social media, mainstream media, life, like, more generally, is that we're expected, and it comes back to this, what we were talking about earlier, like, perfection in a different form. It's not about living your best life. It's about being the best ally or being the best activist and doing it right first time.
Yeah.
Not saying the wrong thing. And if you do say the wrong thing, and I don't really want to get into cancel culture because I don't know enough about it, but running the risk of getting cancelled. And I understand and appreciate like people who really fuck up and like really just get it wrong, and it comes from a place of malice. But if someone is trying to do better and they accidentally, through ignorance or through lack of education or lack of understanding, get it wrong.
Yeah.
That's not a reason to cancel someone or to get rid of someone or to say that they're a bad person. Like, that's the thing. We go from someone saying the wrong thing, making a mistake, to saying that they're a bad person.
And so many people come after them. It's basically a bunch of bullies take away someone's livelihood. That's where I feel there is so much hypocrisy in that. And I try at the moment to focus as much on the positives as I can, which I know can sound really toxic, but there is so much to care about, and you can't care about it all. You cannot live a plastic-free life and be a vegan and donate all your clothes to people in Afghanistan and all the people in Pakistan and try and liberate North Korea and try and like boycott China and do all of these little things that are meant to make you a good person so you can feel good for who?
Yeah.
Because it's people aren't doing that shit for themselves anymore.
No.
They're doing it as like almost a virtue signaling kind of thing. Mm. And like you put something up the other day, you're like, oh, I'm not trying to virtue signal, but like, where can I donate my clothes to Afghans? Like, how can I do that? That's not virtue signaling. That's really kind. Mm. Well done for doing that. But it sucks that people feel that they have to say, oh, I'm not trying to virtue signal.
Yeah.
But
by doing something
I want to do something good. And someone might have said to you, why are you giving your clothes to them? Why aren't you giving it to someone else? Because everyone cares about something different and everyone only has so much capacity to care. And whereas you might like allocate 50% to this and 25% to this, 5% here and all of these different ways, no one's ever going to have the same mix. So The Righteous Mind, have you read it by Jonathan Haidt? It's fucking brilliant, mate. And it was one of the first like proper books with small words that I read. Mm. And there's a piece in there about like these thought experiments. So there's a woman in India and she has fish and chips on a Friday night. How'd you feel about that?
Nothing really. Neutral.
Yeah. Neutral, yeah. So in a little village in India, not to be condescending, but it's a little village in the book. See, look, I'm trying to bounce around for just saying
facts,
a word little.
Facts, yeah.
In her religion, fish is seen as an aphrodisiac because she's a widow. That means she's insulting her dead husband by trying to like be horny by eating fish. Therefore, she's bringing shame on her family, which is a terrible thing in their religion to do. So you think you're right being neutral. They think they're right being fucking outraged. Who's actually right? No one.
Yeah.
No one is. Like, there is no right answer. Another one of the thought experiments there, and I mentioned this in I think my first ever podcast episode, and I was dancing around trying to get the story right. But basically, brother and a sister, 18, 21, go away to France. While they're in France, they're both virgins, and they're like, right, well, like neither of us have had sex before. Maybe we should try having sex. So they wear a condom, she's on the pill anyway, they have sex. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's negative feelings towards it.
Negative.
Yeah.
I think it's fucking gross.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you should have sex with your family.
Agreed.
Why do people don't think you should have sex with your family? Because the genetic sort of implications that will happen on the child. But there was contraception used.
Yeah.
So none of that would happen.
Yeah.
So why is it wrong?
Yeah.
And it's like, you just can't put your sort of finger in it. And it goes into like moral psychology, which is super, super interesting. And I think that book has saved me a lot of upset in the past because if someone thinks differently to me, I'm like, oh, well, they're not right. And I know that I'm not right.
Yeah.
I just think that I am kind of more right than them. So I'm just going to steer clear of this as much as I possibly can.
Yeah.
And it's such a good book to read when it comes to that. I've got it behind you. It's just above your head.
Nice.
Yeah, super, super good book for anyone that's interested in it. But it's like no one's fucking right.
Yeah, and I think I'm really going in on social media today. But it's something we see a lot with social media as well, right? Is that to get engagement, to win the game of social media, you have to massively overgeneralize.
Yeah.
You have to take a stance that is going to make people talk, which is either... You know, let's take the example of the day at the moment, vaccines. You either get put into a bucket of being an anti-vaxxer or being like brainwashed by the government.
Yeah.
And that is how content is created and that's how engagement happens. And people need to realize that people are generalizing for the sake of engagement.
Yeah.
And we get pushed to do that rather than saying, I kind of agree with this. I kind of agree with that. You don't, that, and that's boring to people because you've
like,
taken a stance.
Like, I got the vaccine because I know my mum would be happy with it and I can go on holiday a little bit easier. People will be like, oh my God, you're such a sheep. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I literally couldn't care less.
Yeah.
So I'll go on reading my books and caring about other things and trying to educate another. Like, if they've put something in that kills me, well, that's just fucking how it is.
Unlucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think. It's slightly flippant, but yeah, and that's it. The whole thing at the moment is polarity as well, right? It's you either have to be for or against. There's no grey, like there's the absence of grey, and that is so problematic because it just means that you have to be on one side. Yeah. You don't get to sit on the fence, or not even sit on the fence. You don't get to see both sides. Like, if there were no social pressure, I probably wouldn't have gotten the vaccine because I don't feel that threatened by the virus. And I know that's
anti-vaxxer scum.
Exactly. I don't feel that threatened by the virus. And I know that's a privileged position to be in, but I trust my immune system. And I also look after myself, and I'm young. I'm statistically less likely to die from the virus. I got the vaccine because exactly the same as you. I want to be free to travel. And, you know, the anti-freedom stuff at the moment that's happening with vaccine passports, I personally take a bit of an issue with and take a weak negative stance against.
Yeah.
But also I still got the vaccine because it's going to make my life easier. And ultimately that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
There are bigger things at play, but I think when it comes down to like personal responsibility, you can only take responsibility for what you do as an individual. Yeah. And so let's not talk about vaccines too much because, I mean, it'll get engagement. Everybody.
We love vaccines. Or no, we don't.
We're canceling ourselves.
All right, then. Well, something else that will split opinions is a book that you've got 80 pages left. You told me you read it all, but it doesn't matter. Your Mind on Plants.
Yes. Michael Pollan.
Michael Pollan.
Legend.
What do you think of it?
I loved it. It's actually created change in my life, which rarely happens. Well, it doesn't rarely happen, but I wasn't expecting that book to, because it was more just like a research thing for me. So what does he cover? Opium, caffeine, mescaline. So I first fell in love with his writing, with his not his first book, because he's written a lot of books, but How to Change Your Mind, which is like history of psychedelics and also the modern renaissance of psychedelics in the treatment of mental health. And that really sparked my interest in the space. And it's a space I really enjoy being involved in and also sort of working in loosely as well.
Yeah.
The new book I really, really liked because he went a little bit more into more depth on fewer, you know, substances, plants. The bit that actually created change in my life was the section on caffeine, which was the part I was expecting not to enjoy.
Yeah.
But I've been off caffeine for best part of a year and a bit, and have recently started bringing it back into my life. The way in which he talks about caffeine in the book is he was, you know, drinking 1-2 coffees a day and sort of running on this cycle of drinking coffee, waking up tired, drinking coffee, so on and so forth. And how much of society runs is just this kind of caffeinated cycle of poor sleep, more coffee, poor sleep, more coffee. And sort of just this constant sort of counter or like cyclical way of using caffeine, and that it's been around for years and years and years. And when he gave it up, he then, I don't know where he's at with it now, but he then started using it more as like a tool, more as almost like, in a very loose sense, a plant medicine, to be like, I need to feel energy because I have a deadline for my book. I'm going to drink coffee today. And that for me is how I've started bringing it back into my life, because when I was drinking 3-4 coffees a day working in an office, one coffee wouldn't make any difference. But now that I've given it up, I had a coffee this morning, I can feel like I feel more alert, I feel more energized, I feel more focused. And so now I'm using it in a way, and I'm careful because I know it can be addictive or at least habitual. I've now started bringing it back in either when I'm very, very tired and need to get something done, or just when I feel like I want to focus on this project this afternoon, I'm going to have a coffee. I found the caffeine piece really interesting. And then opium and mescaline were two plants that I knew virtually nothing about and just really enjoyed learning, you know, the impact. And he writes in such a amazing kind of almost investigative journalistic kind of way that he has so much credibility because he's not like, I don't know, he's not some like hip, in inverted commas, like hippie, like plant medicine.
Graham Hancock couldn't write the book, basically.
Exactly. Like you have to, he's come from like, I think he took his first psychedelics in his 50s.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, this isn't someone who's just, it's the same when I heard Christian Angermeyer. Do you know Christian Angermeyer? No. He's a billionaire, like investor. And he was on Stephen Bartlett's podcast talking about psychedelics, among other things. And he'd never touched alcohol or any drugs of any kind. And then I think in his 30s had an experience with psilocybin and is now not a, like, he's now investing in it, now building companies around it. Yeah. And that for me is how you start to build credibility in that space, is saying these people are not your usual kind of druggies that are attached to the 60s stigma of psychedelics. These are business people, entrepreneurs, high achievers who are seriously looking at these substances and how we can use them to benefit society, both from a everyday perspective, but more from like a mental health treatment perspective. So as a book, really, really interesting. Just a bit of a deeper dive into certain substances.
Yeah, I think it's there's a lot of immaturity that surrounds that topic. I think, especially from a lot of people, probably around our age and older, of they're like, "Oh my god, you can't do anything. Like that's really bad for you." And it's like, actually, like you don't know that. You've been fed that information when it was demonized by, I think it was Ronald Reagan or whatever it is, like in the '70s, around the time of Charles Manson. You've been fed that story, or someone older than you has been fed that story. So that's why your prejudice is there.
Yeah.
And that, it just blows my mind, because there's no critical thinking there. There's no willing to sort of educate yourself. There's no like willingness to try it. People are far more happy to go and drink loads and loads of booze, which is a depressant, by the way. And like caffeine, in the book, he says about how caffeine is essentially there to serve capitalism because it makes workers more focused. All of the drugs that we have available to us are being sort of given to us from a slight advantage from the government. I don't know where the advantage of alcohol is. I can't quite find it. But people will like, there will be people that won't listen to my podcast because I once spoke about smoking weed or once spoke about doing psychedelics. And they'll be like, "Oh, I can't possibly listen to that person."
Yeah.
It's like, grow up, mate.
Yeah.
You do whatever you want with your life, I'll do whatever I want with mine. It doesn't sort of take away the credibility of anything I say, because I've learned about it, or I'm actively trying to do more to sort of learn about it.
Basically,
I hate alcohol. Alcohol sucks.
It is the devil. But there's an amazing, I think it's Dr. Carl Hart.
The heroin user guy.
Yes. Yeah. So he
who's obviously way more than just a guy who uses heroin. Yeah. He's a like a professor at Columbia and
he put together this chart. I'm pretty sure it's him, of like harmfulness of substances. And at the top is alcohol, and it's calculated from like harm to the user and harm to others. And alcohol is by far and away like the most. And then I think you've got heroin second, and then it comes down through kind of various different substances. And at the bottom, you've got LSD and psilocybin mushrooms. Yeah. And they are lower than MDMA, lower than ketamine, lower than everything. And like the hallucinogens, the psychedelics are comfortably at the bottom in terms of harm. So if we're looking at it subjectively, scientifically, empirically, it comes down to that critical thinking. Like, if you're interested, do your research. Don't do it on a whim. Don't take the piss. But it's from a harm perspective.
Yeah. It's why I shaved my head. I did some LSD on like a Wednesday.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I felt like I needed a boost of creativity. I felt safe. I felt comfortable. And I was like, well, today's the day.
Yeah.
So got back from jiu-jitsu and it was like 12 o'clock. And stuck it on my tongue, left it there for like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And within 2 hours, I was on Clapham Common eating a knobbly bobbly.
Nice.
And I was having a good time. Nothing profound. Came home, watched Avatar, and I was like, I need to be a vegetarian. And then after the thoughts of I need to be a vegetarian, I was like, I'm going to shave my head.
Nice.
I was like, I can't obviously shave my head whilst I'm tripping, because that'll be a silly thing.
Yeah.
The next day I did it, and there is just a feeling of connectedness to the world that you get from psychedelics, which I'm sure contributes to people's scepticism around it. But it just like it's not a bad. There's not much of a. I'm trying to think. Like, have you ever heard stories of people having negative experiences, killing someone, being violent, anything like that that's come from LSD?
The closest you get to those stories with any kind of psychedelic are people not coming back down from a trip.
Yeah.
And that seems to be extremely rare. It's obviously a real phenomena, but very rare. And the other side of it is, if you already have a propensity to things like schizophrenia or bipolar, it could trigger that in your brain.
Yeah.
But that's where the safety comes into it. Like, I've spoken about it quite a lot on my podcast with people that are very much immersed in the space, and even with people outside of it, and people that are just interested. And there's a real sense, and I think this is where we need to be careful, and Michael Pollan talks about it in How to Change Your Mind. It's like, the potential of these substances in a professional, therapeutic, sometimes personal, in certain cases, setting is massive. However, if we fall back into what we saw in the 60s of high recreational use and people taking the piss and people in some possible way creating harm, then we're going to lose all of the progress that's been made. And that for me is, that's the risk of popularizing this stuff, because there's still research that needs to go in and there's still work that needs to be done. And I think we're seeing more and more of it. And had the one of the founders of Compass Pathways on my podcast, one of the, or the largest private psychedelic therapy business in the world. And they're doing amazing work and are really digging into, like, how can we make this real? How can we get, like, centers that people can go to for treatment? Because we're already seeing in the States, like, ketamine therapy centers, trials for MDMA for PTSD, psilocybin, LSD, like, all of these things popping up. And it's early, but they do think, like, 2024, 2025, we might actually start seeing this stuff in reality and, like, being used for really positive benefits, so...
Yeah, and I think when people hear, like, ketamine therapy, it's not people putting their nose in a bag full of dried-up tranquilizer. It's an intravenous, very, very small dose that I think allows you, from the stuff that I've listened to, I listened to Theo Von, has done ketamine therapy, like, a course of 10 weeks, and he's had a really troubled life. Mm. And he said it just allowed him to get to a position within his thinking that he'd never accessed before. Mm. So he could bring up things that were necessary for his healing, which is super, super interesting. And no matter how much, like, people spread that message, there is going to be the negative connotations of people thinking, well, someone's literally just got a small bag full of white powder, they're putting a key in it and then sniffing it and lying down on a therapy bed. Like, that would never, ever happen.
Yeah, I think that's where the language, again, to come back to language, is important, because whenever we talk about psychedelic therapy, I think the correct language is probably psychedelic assisted therapy, because it's therapy that's assisted by these substances, and it's very carefully done with work beforehand with a therapist or two, sometimes three there in a session, and then integration is such a big part of it, to say, okay, you had this experience, what does that mean? Because essentially the theory, and it's not kind of hard research at the moment, but it's definitely starting to come through, is that with something like psilocybin, you actually access increased neuroplasticity in the brain. So you have the potential to create new neural pathways and create new habits and behaviors in the time afterwards, which is essentially how to change your life. Like, that's what we're all striving for in therapy and coaching. It's like changing the way you think, changing your mindset to change how you act. Like, you have to change the underlying thought process before you change the behavior. And that for me is one of the really interesting things that I love about breath work is, and this is where I'm hoping to go a bit more into the research side of it, is looking at specifically what's going on in the brain, because there's a lot to be said in terms of brain activity between some psychedelics and breath work. And that's why you see a lot of the same themes around, like, the music and the setting that you're in, and the integration side of it is, like, how can that experience shape what you're doing? And like with the Theo Von stuff, like, that's a similar experience to what I had at that session that made me want to be a breath worker. Was, I come back to this quote, like, you have to go there to know that I access, like, thought and feelings that I hadn't felt before in my life. And so I was like, oh, that's a thing that I actually could feel. Like, I felt this joy that I'd never felt before. And as someone who has had depression or struggled with depression in the past, I was like, oh shit, I can feel that happy. And so I was like, okay, well, how do I create situations where I can feel that happy in my life day to day? So yeah, that's a nice clean segue to breathwork.
Yeah, that is very nice. Well, I'm conscious of I've got jiu-jitsu, basically. So to round it off, where can people find you if they should so want to, and what's going on with the breathwork? Is there anything people can get involved in?
Yeah,
you're doing a lot of community workshop stuff now.
Yeah, the community workshop stuff is ticking along, usually once a month, but sometimes a couple of times a month if I can be bothered. So those are all online workshops. I've got one coming up on the 12th of September. If people want to find me at the_breath_space or at @JamieClements_, so yeah, that's kind of what's going on at the moment. I think I'm starting to teach a bit more in person. Hopefully going to be running some retreats, Man Down podcast. Got a new episode coming out this week with Mo Gowdat, which should be cool. And yeah, just if anybody wants to chat, then it's always fun to chat to people who actually want to talk to you. So
that is very true. It is. Well, I love chatting to you, so thank you very much
thank
for coming
you,
on, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Never.
Well, there you have it. Hopefully you enjoyed that episode. I very much enjoyed recording it. If you did like it, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or sharing the episode with a friend, family member, some randomer on the street. It doesn't matter as long as you share it. Put it on your LinkedIn. LinkedIn posts go so far, and you get to let all of your LinkedIn friends know that you read books. Such a win-win. Anyway, that is it from me. You're all absolute legends. Love you, bye.